Let's continue with our fourth section of the chemistry of life. Remember that they're working here on the beach. They're taking care of their palm fronds, making them into mulch. And, you know, we're still on the beach, so it can't be all that bad. So if you hear any noise in the background, you know that's what's going on. Let's talk about the classic chemical reaction. We want to memorize this reaction only because you're going to see it again and again. And this is going to be where we take carbon dioxide and water, and we get a product called carbonic acid. Now, this is going to be a reversible reaction. So the direction of the reaction can go either way. You can go from carbon dioxide water to carbonic acid, or you can go from bicarbonate ion hydrogens to carbonic acid. So you can go back and forth. It all depends on which way you're going to be going. So the quantities determine the direction of the reaction. Either you're going to go towards one side, be going towards the other side, depending on what's going on, depending on what the quantities of each of the components are. For instance, let's say you have too much carbon dioxide in the body. That's going to make more carbonic acid. So, or let's say you have too many hydrogen ions in the body. That's going to make more carbonic acid as well. So if you look at it this way, you can sort of see how it's a reversible reaction. It's still a classic reaction. Remember, reversible chemical reactions are going to go in either direction. So we use paired arrows to let us know that a reversible reaction can take place. The direction of the reaction, once again, is determined by how much of substances are going to be on either side. When we look at pH, pH is going to be a phenomenon of acidity or alkalinity in a substance. We can have it in the soil, we can have it in a solution, a variety of places in a powder. It all depends on the number or the power of hydrogen. Whether or not if we increase our hydrogens in a substance, we're going to decrease the pH. Let me say that again. As we increase the hydrogens, we're going to decrease the pH. So in other words, we become more acidic as we increase our hydrogens. As we decrease our hydrogens, we tend to become more alkaline, or our pH goes up. So we'll talk more about this, but it's an inverse proportion with the hydrogens, even though we call it the power of hydrogen. That's what the small p, big H means. Remember, big H stands for, or is the symbol for hydrogen. So p, small p, big H is going to be the pH. Now, how many hydrogen ions are released solution are going to determine what's going to be going on as far as pH is concerned. So when we look at the substance in a solution, we're going to be seeing it dissociate. And disassociation is going to be exactly that. If you had a friend and then you no longer like that friend, you would disassociate from them. You wouldn't take their calls. You wouldn't take their texts. You would just disassociate yourself. Well, what happens with solutions is that we can have substances dissolved in them, and then they can break away from each other. As they break away from each other, then we see that they can have a increased hydrogens or decreased hydrogens. Either way, they have increased hydrogens, and it's going to be more acidic. Decreased hydrogens are going to be more alkaline or more basic. So in pure water, then, pure water is going to have a pH of 7. It's going to be neutral. Neutral? Because when it dissociates equally into hydroxide ions and hydrogen ions. Hydroxide ions are going to be those ions that are going to contain an oxygen. They're going to be more negative. Hydrogen ions are going to be more positive because they have lost their electron. So the number of hydrogen ions and the number of hydroxide ions is going to be the same. So therefore, in water, in pure water, you have a pH of 7. So 7 is going to be the middle part of the pH scale. If you have more hydrogen ions, the solution is going to be more acid. If you have more hydroxide ions, the solution is going to be basic, or we call it alkaline. The greater the hydrogen ions, the lower the pH. So there's that inverse proportion. Let's look at our pH scale. First of all, I have neutral at 7. we go to the left of our pH scale, down towards 1, we see that we're going to increase our acidity. So as we increase our acidity, we increase our hydrogen ions. So we go to the left of the pH scale. As we decrease our acidity, or go to the right of neutral, we're going to decrease the hydrogen ions, but increase the hydroxide ions. So as we go to the right, our hydroxide ions increase, our hydrogen ions decrease, and what happens here is that we start to go to alkalinity, or it becomes more basic. So the numbers are going to go from 1 to 14, sorry, from 0 to 14 on the pH scale. 0 to 7, 0 to 6.9, let's put it that way, is going to be acid. 7.1 to 14 is going to be basic or alkaline. So as the number increases, the pH decreases. Do you see? Sorry. As the number increases, the hydrogen ions decrease. So our acidity decreases. As we go to the left, our hydrogen ions increase, so we increase our acidity. So hopefully that's you have to think about it, but it's a good scale, and it makes sense once you think about it. Now, sometimes things get too alkaline, or things get too acidic, particularly in the body. And if they get too alkaline or too acidic, we have to buffer these so that we can keep our fluids mostly at neutral. So to maintain homeostasis, a buffer is going to be used to make an acid less acid or a base less basic. So we use the classic representation again of a bicarbonate ion. So a bicarbonate, like let's say Arm & Hammer baking soda. Baking soda would be a bicarbonate. And the person has, for instance, let's say too much acid. Let's say they just had a big, huge meal, and they produce too much acid, and they feel really, like real bloated. So what you do is you give them the Arm & Hammer baking soda. You take just 1 tablespoon and about 4 ounces of water, mix it up, give it to them. What will happen is that it will buffer all that acid. It will take the hydrogen ions, it will mix them together with the bicarbonate, and what you'll get is water and dioxide. So what the person will eventually do is they will burp, because the carbon dioxide is going to be in a form of a gas. The person will burp and they'll feel better, because then you know that this reaction has occurred, the buffering reaction. Now acids are going to release hydrogen ions in solutions. Bases are going to release not hydrogen ions, but what? Hydroxide ions in solution. Now there can be substances that are not going to be acid or bases. These are called salts. Salts release something other than hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions. When they dissociate, they dissociate into other substances rather than hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions. And salts will release other things, such as, for instance, our common table salt, which is sodium chloride. When it dissociates, it's going to dissociate into those two, into sodium and chloride. Now carbon. Carbon is going to be in all living things. You've heard of organic vegetables, or organic farming, or organic foods. These are all going to be containing carbon. Anything that's going to be organic contains carbon. If you study organic chemistry, you're going to be studying carbon. So inorganic chemistry is where you do not study carbon, where you study other things besides carbon. Fertilizers are inorganic, so they're not going to be containing carbon. If you think about a fertilizer, if you go to Home Depot, you'll see there'll be fertilizers and it'll be like 3 numbers on it. That's representative of nothing to do with carbon. It has all to do with how much potassium is in there, how much nitrogen's in there, how much potash is in there, potassium. Well, it's potassium and nitrogen. I forget what the other one is. But there's no carbon. carbon there. You'll notice that when you get black cow or any kind of organic fertilizer, that's just cow poop. And they don't put the, you know, they can put the, how much is in there, but they usually don't because it's just going to be an organic compound. It's manure. So all things are going to contain, all things that are organic are going to contain carbon, is the point. Now carbon is so important for life because it plays well with others. Carbon has four bonding sites. So it's going to be a symmetrical molecule that's going to be formed from anything that's going to be bonding to carbon. This makes carbon very versatile. It makes carbon very stable. Carbon only has four electrons in its outer shell. It wants four more. So carbon is considered the backbone of living things because it can combine so readily with so many things. So carbon makes up the main organic molecules, such as lipids, carbohydrates, proteins, nucleic acids. Lipids are our fats, the fats that we have in our diet. Carbohydrates are going to be those energy sources that we have in our diet, the immediate energy sources, such as potatoes, such as fruit drinks, such as sugars. Such kind of sugars will be carbohydrates. Proteins are going to be the building blocks of our body. This is going to be meats and eggs and soybeans and these kinds of proteins. And then we have nucleic acids, which are actually going to be right inside of the nucleus of the cell. Such things as DNA and RNA and even ATP, which is an energy source. We know that nucleic acids are found inside of the nucleus, like DNA and RNA, because their name says that. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. So we have a nucleic acid aspect, and nucleic, of course, means nucleus. So it's going to be found in the nucleus. Whereas RNA is going to be ribonucleic acid. So that's how that works. Now when we look at some of our functional groups, we see that small clusters of atoms attach to carbon backbones. This determines many of the properties of the organic molecule. We have hydroxyls, we have methyls, we have carboxyls, we have aminos, we have phosphates. These are just a few of the examples of functional groups that sort of like hitchhike on the carbon. Now, as you already alluded to, ATP is going to be an energy source. ATP is still going to be one of those nucleic acids that we just talked about, but it's going to be important for energy. And the molecule that supplies the cell with energy is going to be called this universal energy currency, which is going to be ATP. ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. Adenine is a nucleotide base. We'll talk more about this when we talk about genetics. But it's a nucleotide base. This is bonded to three phosphates with high energy bonds. So what happens is that we have this nucleotide base, adenine, and then it has these high energy bonds attached to it. So if you break one of these high energy bonds, you get energy from it. It'd be like taking a spring and pushing a spring real, 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 real hard together, and then letting it go, and you'll see it really springs all over the place. That's sort of the same thing. These high energy bonds are these springs that are pushed together real, 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 real tight, and then you let them go, and they spring out. That's sort of like the high energy bonds that are in the ATP. So once ATP expends its energy or loses that one bond, it becomes a different substance, and it becomes ADP, or adenosine diphosphate, because it lost one of its phosphates. It's no longer tried. It's dye. So ADP plus one phosphate is called ATP. So ATP is made from ADP by cellular respiration. So you have to, your cells have to create its own ATP. And it does that through the mitochondria. If you remember, we talked about the cell. We talked about the mighty mitochondria. Oh, we didn't talk about that yet. We'll talk about that later. But that's going to be in the portion in the, it's called the mitochondria. But wait for that. That will be in the next chapter. Now ATP is the body's most important energy molecule because ATP contains adenine, as we said. Also contains a ribose, so that's a sugar. But the key is that it contains these three phosphates, and with their high energy bonds. Now let's look at some monomers and some polymers. Mono means one, and mer means part. And if we say a polymer, then we know that must be many parts. So a monomer is going to be one part of a polymer. So when we look at lipids, we see that lipids are going to be fatty acids, which are monomers, that form the polymer called lipids. So fatty acids are going to be the base, if you will, of the lipids. Now a carbohydrate is going to have saccharides as its base. That's going to put together until it becomes a polysaccharide that we call carbohydrates. A protein is going to have as its base amino acids. So amino acids are going to build up to become polypeptides, which are called proteins. Now the reason we call them polypeptides is because the bond that's between two amino acids is called a peptide bond. So as a review, if we look at lipids, we see we have monomers of fatty acids. The polymer would be the lipid. If we take a carbohydrate and break it down into its component parts, we're going to get a saccharide. If we put a bunch of saccharides together, we're going to be getting the more sophisticated polysaccharides. If we take our proteins, the base of them is going to be the amino acids. We put a bunch of proteins or a bunch of amino acids together, we get a protein can call a polypeptide. Now the way that we make a polymer is we have to combine these elements. So we have to combine a bunch of monomers to get a polypeptide, and we have to break down a polypeptide into monomers to actually utilize them. So we eat a carbohydrate, for instance. We have to break that polysaccharide down into the saccharide so we can use it for energy. Similarly, if we have a bunch of amino acids in our body, we need to put them together so that they can create our tissues. So we have to go one way or the other. Either we are going to condense or put together or combine these monomers, such as putting a bunch of amino acids together to make a protein, or we got to break these guys apart. So we break apart the carbohydrates so that we can get saccharides, so we can get our energy source from that. So we can use that to make ATP. So, to combine monomers, we need to use a condensation reaction. I wish I would get done with this tree trimming here. Okay, so we're going to be doing the condensation reaction. This reaction is where we lose water. A hydrolysis reaction is just the opposite. This is where we actually are going to add water or gain water to the reaction. So a condensation reaction is A plus B equals AB, whereas a hydrolysis reaction is A and B together equal A plus B. The reaction works better with enzymes. So a condensation reaction will be a reaction where we will get water because we're condensing it. You know, sometimes you look at fruit juice, and you'll see it's from concentrate. What they mean is that water was taken out, so it was condensed, is really what they're saying. Now, in hydrolysis, what we do is we add water, and then we break the bonds. So we actually break the bonds in hydrolysis. Hydro means water, lysis means to break. Now, in our lipids, we see that they're going to be short chains of carbons. The lipid is a phospholipid, if you add a phosphate to it. This is important for the cell coverings. Lipids can be either saturated fats or unsaturated fats. If they are saturated with hydrogen, they're going to be called a saturated fat. If they don't have as many hydrogens, then we call them unsaturated fat. Saturated fats tend to be found in animals. Unsaturated fats tend to be found in plants. The mnemonic is sun. Unsaturated comes from the sun. The sun also has a U in it to tell you that it's unsaturated. The The exceptions to plants being unsaturated is coconut oil and palm oils. Coconut oil and palm oils are saturated fats naturally. Now the qualities of saturated fats and unsaturated fats is going to be this. Saturated fats are going to be solid at room temperature. So you think of butter, you think of coconut oil, you know, you think of, well, coconut oil really isn't solid at room temperature, I don't think, is it? Maybe, partially I guess it could be, yeah. But you think of lard, you know, Crisco, all these things are saturated. That's the reason that they're solid at room temperature. Unsaturated fats will be liquid at room temperature. Think of safflower oil, or think of canola oil. Any of these oils are going to be unsaturated, because they're going to be liquid at room temperature. Good, they're starting to stop that. Excellent. Trees look nice, though, I must say. But you know, you want palm trees on the beach. You want them to be full, but you don't want those coconuts, because I guess the city would be upset if a coconut landed on someone's head and then they were sued, so I have to get rid of those coconuts, too. But it's nice. It's nice out here. Where was I? Oh, yes. So we're going to talk about carbohydrates. Carbohydrates come in really a simple form or a complex form. Simple form, we're going to be calling them monosaccharides. We call them simple sugars. These are the sugars that will raise your blood sugar right away, such as taking in glucose syrup. There's some sports drinks that have glucose syrup in it. So it raises your blood sugar right away. And the other complex carbohydrates are more what we should be eating, such as whole grains, starches, plants, like whole potatoes, things like that. And the simple sugars are going to be monosaccharides, like glucose, for instance. Glucose is a combination of three, no, it's a six-carbon sugar, and it's a monosaccharide. And also a fructose would be a monosaccharide as well. It's a common fruit sugar. Typically, the carbohydrates have short chains. That can be another kind of carbohydrate that's sort of getting into almost the polysaccharide phase. If you combine two of the monosaccharides together, you get a short chain carbohydrate. We would still consider that a simple sugar. The complex sugars are going to be the polysaccharides. As we said, starch, potato has starch, so that would be a complex carbohydrate. The glycogen, which is going to be a complex carbohydrate, that's the storage of energy in our body. Also, bugs have chitin, which is going to be their shell, which is actually made out of carbohydrates as well. That's the reason some people feel that bugs taste good, because they are, you know, basically carbohydrates. And cellulose also is another carbohydrate, complex carbohydrate. Remember, cellulose is going to be in the cell wall. Now, proteins are going to be the Greek word for of first importance. And proteins are very important in our diet because they're going to really benefit us in a variety of ways. Now, a polymer of amino acids is called a polypeptide chain. These are named after the bonds that form between the amino acids called the peptide bonds that I already mentioned. The simplest polypeptide, therefore the simplest protein, is insulin. Insulin only contains 51 amino acids. It's the simplest because it's one of the most important proteins that we have. It allows for the transport of glucose, energy, into the cells. Very important. So that the cells can make their ATP. Proteins can fold allow for functioning, such as in hemoglobin. Hemoglobin, which is a protein in our blood, actually folds on itself so that it can hold oxygen. That's the way it works. Now, the functional group of organic molecules, or proteins, have parts that are called a carboxyl functioning group at one end, and an amino functioning group at the other end. They don't vary in their amino acids. These guys are stable. What does vary is the R group. And the R group is sort of like, if you picture the amino and carboxyl group of the amino acids being like an airplane, picture the R group as being like the luggage that's put into the belly of the airplane. The luggage constantly changes, but the airplane itself does not change. different amino acids. You keep the same amino group and carboxyl group, but then you add different parts to the R group section. And that makes different amino acids. Like, if you want glycine, which is an amino acid, all you do is you just add an H in the R group area. But if you want lysine, then you got to add a bunch of carbons and a nitrogen to get lysine. But it can change back and forth depending on what you put in the R group. That's going to change what amino acids you have. Now, proteins can become denatured. That means that they will go away from what their nature is. Like, for instance, the nature of an egg is to nurture the new chick. But what we can do is we can cook that. And we cook that egg, and now that clear substance that's around the yolk now becomes white. So the white of the egg now is representing denatured protein. That means that it could no longer fulfill its duty, which would be to benefit a chick. Chick couldn't eat a cooked egg. It would not benefit him. It would be against his nature. Or it would be denatured. So it doesn't mean that it's bad, it just means that the protein is no longer able to fulfill its nature. We call it denatured. Now, to denature proteins, you can expose it to heavy metals, you can put acids or bases on it, you can heat it like a cooked egg. If a protein is denatured, then it can't fulfill its function. So to be the color of your eyes or the shape of your nose, it would need to have that certain shape. Just like we looked at the shape of the protein hemoglobin. Hemoglobin needs to be shaped in that way for it to hold oxygen. If it was denatured, it would not have that shape any longer, and it would not be able to fulfill its nature, which was to carry oxygen.